primary purpose here today is to gather historical data that can be used in our educational system, and hopefully will enlighten the public as to the rich aviation heritage that the state of Alaska has. Without much further ado, I'd like to introduce our first speaker, Mr. Tony Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Spencer. I'd like to compliment Mr. Spencer on giving up his job and going full time to get this program going. I think that, shall we say, looking to the future, 100 years from now, the kids are going to come along and they're going to say, well, what was so tough about it? Well, they're going to have a few pictures and something documentary to show that, shall we say, it wasn't all roses. And Ray Peterson and I can tell you, it gets pretty cold in the interior, and the fire pot doesn't exactly do a job of keeping your feet warm while you're trying to warm the airplane. First, I'd like to tell you about one of my students. Ray knows him. Fritz Aw. Fritz is a gold miner, and then he went to work for the government. But the thing I want to tell you about him was that when they wanted to develop the Ice Island project, later known as T3, they had mapped this thing and checked it on radar, and they didn't know how they were going to make a landing on it, so they got an airplane that I believe it was a C-130, and put a DC-4 in it with three parachutes and dropped this D-4 tractor on the island. And then Fritz Aw went up there and jumped out in this sub-zero weather and started this machine up and dozed out a runway and made it possible for them to establish a base which Arctic Research at Point Barrow had used for many years. I don't know exactly how many, but it was about 13 or 14 years, and garnered much information from this project. And the island later drifted south by Iceland and disintegrated in the warmer water. Second, there's a small book on the Mad Trapper, and in this book it tells how the mounted police were trying to run this man down. They spent 6 weeks with many dogs and many men. And the first airplane was used on this project, shall we say, as cover in a manhunt. I saw some pictures, or there were some pictures in this book. I don't remember the author, but there's a book out on it. There should be one in the state library. This will give you some background of how tough the conditions were from the standpoint of the pilots trying to, one, find their way around in the cold weather and that far north with the short hours of daylight in the wintertime. I'd like to pay tribute now to Sam White. Sam White, as you know, was a legend in the Fairbanks area, and he had started out as a game warden. He'd been up here for quite a few years, and I believe Noah Ween taught him to fly. Sam had a OX-5 on skis, and in 1939, he had flown from Fort Yukon to Old Crow, and while he was there, the Mountie mentioned to him how some trappers had gone to the south fork of the Porcupine River, which is maybe 60, 70 miles out of Old Crow. So he said, well, let's go up there and see how they're doing. So they left 2 days earlier, so they flew up there and spotted these trappers and landed and talked to them. These natives looked at him and said, "When did you leave?" "Oh," he said, "by the mountain," he said, "about 30 minutes ago." The next one come along and asked the question a little bit different. This was a whole new concept. They couldn't believe that man suddenly could surpass the speed of the dog team. And so they visited with them there for a while, and then they had gone back to Fort Yukon. To Old Crow, and then Sam, of course, went back to Fort Yukon, which was his base. By the way, if anybody of you need any information on some of Sam's stories, I have a stack of his, real short stories, about 3 or 4 inches in height, and with the language that Sam uses. Some of it, I guess, wouldn't quite get in the book, but it's pretty descriptive. I'd like to tell you one of my experiences dating back to, I believe it's 1943, February 43. I was at that time flying for Alaska Airlines. It was Alaska Star at that time. And this is history now. And I was flying down the Yukon River, and on this particular day, I heard Tony Kumez call him to Bethel and tell him how he had seen 4 balloons, and that when he called the station there, Max Lieb told him, Max said, "Well, what have you been drinking?" So, on the basis of this remark, or the answer to his statement, about 5 days later, I was flying down the Yukon to Fortuna Ledge, and as I made the turn at the Devil's Elbow there in a heavy snowstorm, I saw 2 Japanese balloons about, I imagine they were 30, 40 feet in diameter. Just off my right wing, I could have tangled with them in a snowstorm and wouldn't have time to evade them. Anyway, because of the remark that was made to Gomez, I didn't tell anybody what I saw. But a few days later, one of the sergeants in the Alaska National Guard, who happened to run across one of these on his trap line, and he picked this thing up and put it on his sled and brought it into Fortuna Ledge. So they sent a coded message to Elmendorf and describing the item. And Elmendorf sent the message back, I found out later from Colonel Marston, and said they would like to have another statement. And so they sent another coded message describing this balloon and its attachments. And so at this time, they called Colonel Marston in and really put him on the carpet, said, "Look, at your man's giving us a tall story here." So he said, "Well, I know my sergeant," and he says, "I think he's telling the truth." So they asked for the third message, and when it came back with the text basically the same, they dispatched an airplane from Anchorage with an OSI man. The pilot on that airplane was Bill Fike with Alaska Airlines, Alaska Star at that time, Lockheed Orion 230Y. By the way, 230Y was first used by Varney Airlines in California. And at that time, it was a pretty sleek little airplane. Anyway, they landed at Fortuna Ledge on the ice on wheels, and I happened to fortunately be there as they were spreading the thing out to look at it and figure out how they were going to load it on the airplane. So I told the OSI man how I had seen these 2 balloons a few days before. So I asked him for a sample of the fabric, which he decided maybe I could have a small chunk. Anyway, I cut out a chunk about 4 feet square. So he said, "We have an Elmendorf, a DC-4 sitting there full of gas, And the crew is resting, and he said, when I get in with this thing, the next stop's Washington, D.C. So I took my little sample of this and went on my way up to Fairbanks. By the way, I want to step there a little bit and tell you that this thing had a hoop about a yard across, it was arranged around the edges with the numerous, there are about, oh, I would say 70 cartridges, and this aneroid type barometer, which sense the different air pressure, would move this arm around to another cartridge and fire it electrically to kick off a sack of sand to maintain a given altitude based on the pressure. And so this, I sized up all this mechanism, and in the middle, as a cargo, was a little box of kind of jelly-like suet, and in about the size of a honeybee box. And I asked this man, he said, well, he said he was pretty sure it was some kind of germ warfare, type of germs in that. And they would, of course, along with everything else, have been analyzed. Anyway, I didn't get the results of that, but I did want to describe to you what the payload of this particular balloon was. And as you know, there were 3,860 of these balloons that were released, and only one case where they are known to have any serious damage, and that was at a Sunday school picnic about 7-8 years later in Washington or Oregon, somewhere along the coast there, where some kids on a picnic were 11 of them killed when they set off a shrapnel type charge that was attached to that particular balloon. And I took the sample of this into Fairbanks and called up my friend in the FBI, Stanley Baskin, and told him what I had. He said, well, don't go anywhere, don't do anything, don't call anybody, I'll be there in 5 minutes. So when I told him what I had and where it came from, he took it, and that's the way I lost my sample. So I hope Stanley has a good time with it. I have one other item I'd like to tell you about because it's history, and that is an experience I had while flying with Marine Airlines. I was flying out of Kotzebue and into Cape Thompson, and on this particular day, I had been to, it was in the fall of the year, and I'd been to Kiana to take some of the workmen back to Kiana, and I had several options. One, I could stay in Kiana or go to Kotzebue or go back to the camp. Well, because I had several emergencies, in fact, five of them in the previous week, for one reason or another, I decided to go back to the camp in the dark, even though I didn't have a lighted runway. And on the way back, the weather to the east of me had been cloudy and raining, and when I broke out over the NOAATAC flying on a northwesterly course, I saw off my to the left what looked like a pool of fire, like an airplane had hit the ocean, and this had burst into flames, and the flames were coming up around the edges of this thing, and you could just see the dark streaks through it, just like burning gasoline. So I thought, well, surely some airplane is flown into the water. So I knew right away that it was quite important to have the exact time. So each time we go out on the departure from a place like Kotzebue, where they give you the weather and the wind and so on, so they also give you the time. So my watch in the airplane was relatively correct. And so I looked at the time, it was 1 minute to six. And this pool of fire just kept on spreading out and rolling around the edges, and shall we say it would be about 1/4 of the height in proportion to the width of this thing. And I just didn't know, there was no explanation except that it had to be burning gasoline. But after approximately a minute and a quarter, out of the base of this thing, there descended a sphere as red as red hot copper and as round as an orange. Now then, I knew I was seeing something far different than anything I had experienced in my life to this time. So I checked, and as near as I could tell, from the time that this sphere was descending until it went below the horizon was between 35 and 40 seconds. Now, this is a time element here is very important. As we later found out, this helped them determine the height of this cloud of fire. So after this thing had gone, descended below the surface, and within approximately another half a minute, there appeared two lines as precise as if you had drawn them with the chalk, setting parallel to the Earth's surface within, between the cloud and a fire and the horizon. And these lines were just as white as if they'd been painted on them. And I called them lines of pressure, and I found out that is correct later, that they're lines of negative pressure. In other words, the explosion had driven this out with such force that created a kind of a vacuum there. Anyway, this slowly dissipated, and the cloud, the fallout from this cloud was just like red rain falling. And the total time from the time I saw it until it was still a rosy glow on the horizon, and remember, I can't see the ground even from 4,000 or 5,000 feet for more than 100 miles or thereabouts. So it had to be greater than that. And this, at the end of 4 minutes, there was still a rosy glow. And at this time, I called Kotzebue Radio, and I said, Kotzebue Radio, this is Wing 31 Delta. Be advised that the Russians have set off another atomic blast. This became visible at 5:09 and lasted for 4 minutes. Advise military intelligence, and this is not for news release. Well, the guy in Kotzebue was on the ball, forwarded this on, and being Friday night, nothing happened in the military, but Senator Bartlett told me later that Monday morning he got a call to be in the president's office at 7 o'clock in the morning. And he said, you know, I live 60 miles out the country. And he said, that wasn't easy to do. But he said, I was there, and he handed me this little piece of paper. And he said, Senator Bartlett, do you know this man? He said, he read this teletype description. And he said, Mr. President, I not only know this man, I have flown with him. And Kennedy said, well, can we rely on his report? And Bartlett said, absolutely. So then on the basis of this, they dispatched a U-2 out of Eielson to fly over there and take pictures and sample the air. And this U-2 stayed over there, over Siberia, taking pictures so long that he ran out of fuel 150 miles out of Kotzebue at 60,000 feet and coasted in and landed at Kotzebue. And to quote Cliff Everts, and he says, and there we were, clear day, and not too much gasoline, and he said, they wouldn't let us land, and we had to go to Nome. And they just, shall we say, were squeezing the tank. Anyway, I was told later that the military came over there and took the samples out of the off the camera, and the air sampling, or the photos out of the camera, and they sample and device for the air, and this man put him in his satchel and chained the satchel to his wrist and got him a DC-3 and flew off to Alston. We never got any further reports on this, but this did show how they were getting the, shall we say, pinch on the Russians were saying they were setting this explosive or this device off approximately 1,200 miles farther northwest, when in reality it was right on the East Cape area, shall we say, within 100 miles or thereabouts, I think. And that we in Alaska and the Pacific Northwest were getting all the fallout. In closing, I'd like to say that I feel that this is probably the most important contribution I'll ever make to my country. Thank you.
There's a... What?
Let me introduce you properly.
Well, I thought I had a better one.
This is Mr. Bob Ellis. He's a very illustrious aviator in our history. He came up here in 1929 in the first flight from Seattle to Juneau, and he initiated his experiences in commercial flying in Alaska in the Lockheed Vega. And I've read his book, and very enjoyable little cardback book that I hope he will make available to the people here. And without much further ado, I'd like to have him tell some of his experiences up here.
Thank you, Ted, for the nice introduction and the opportunity to speak to some of my favorite people who are in the aviation or have been in the aviation. You know, in Jean Potter's book, she made quite a point of speaking about the aviation. I'm hoping maybe we can revise that colloquialism. Ted spoke about my arrival in Alaska, and we all like to tell about the first arrival in Alaska, how we came, or how much money we had in our pockets, or what the particular facts or fancies were. I arrived in Alaska in 1929, and I was a red-ass kid. And I'll tell you just why I was a red-ass kid. Ansel Eckman was with Alaska Washington Airways and was planning a nonstop flight, promotional flight, from Seattle to Juneau, preparatory to initiating a commercial service in Southeastern. So Ansel had a pretty good pilot, but he'd skipped some of his ground school, and I persuaded him to take me along as a navigator. In fact, I did this the day before. And the next night I was in Juneau. It was flying a Lockheed Vega, the three of us aboard, Jack Halloran, a mechanic, Ansel Eckman, the pilot, and I was the navigator. We had 120 gallons of gasoline in the cabin in 5-gallon cans. And it was Halloran's job to pump it up. And the old pilots remember how we used to have a wobble pump in the cabin. You could pump it up into the tanks. And shortly after takeoff, Eckman opened the door of the Lockheed Vega and says, "Come on up, Bob." And to get up into the cockpit, and if you, those of you who may remember the Vega, you had to go feet first. You didn't walk in. There was only one way to get in. And with the 5-gallon cans there, you had to go in sliding along on your back. And one of the cans was leaking on the top. with a little bit of gasoline on the top. And I absorb quite a bit of this gasoline on my bottom. And so pretty soon I was squirming around, and Ackman said, what's the matter? And I told him, he said, well, take your pants off. Well, so I did, and I was a little more comfortable. But by that time, the gasoline had done its work, so that when I arrived in Alaska, I was the original red-ass kid. I've been programmed to talk about programs. That's sort of like you program computers, don't you, to get smarter answers than you can think up. Well, anyhow, I've been programmed to talk of some of the more serious aspects of commercial aviation in Alaska. I can't tell from here if this loudspeaker is working. You hear me? In the 30s, it's unbelievable now, but actually we had over 100 airmen in Alaska making flying, making some sort of a living out of it. And we had well over 50 companies in Alaska. I'm amazed at the count. I got some of the count out of Steve Mills' book, and I couldn't believe it until I started reading it. So I do know that it's true. And some of those original aviators are still alive and well. Some are here today. See Ray Peterson, Bill Avery's around, and we know Smitty and Sig Ween and Art Woodley. Frank Barr is here. He's over there with his camera. Clayton Scott's down in Seattle, still working out there at Renton Airport. I don't know how active he is. Bob Rees is here in town. We know that he's with us in spirit, if not here today. So quite a few of the people are still around. You might ask, how did you people find your way around in those days? Well, if you're a coastal pilot like I was, it wasn't too bad because you could use marine charts. And if you're one of the original pilots, you flew from Anchorage to Fairbanks, and like Noah Ween did, and you just followed the railroad. But the other maps of the territory were the Alaska Road Commission maps, and which is sort of blueprints, and which had some pretty big blank spaces in these blueprints, but generally they showed where the rivers were, the drainage systems. And if you could find yourself to your way up to the top of the divide, all you had to do was find a river on the other side that would lead you down to McGrath or Michigan or whatever place you wanted to go. But I remember one particular chart in particular, which was down in Ray Peterson's area. If you wanted to fly from Bethel to Michigan, you either followed the coast or you blundered across country, and the map said mountains 3,000 feet high. They were really bigger than that. And also numerous large lakes, and that was all it said in this particular area. The numerous large lakes turned out to be what we now know as the Tick-Tick Lake Country, a beautiful country, and they are numerous, large, and quite beautiful. So that was the way we found our way around. And these tributaries that I mentioned remind me somewhat of the various corporate airlines that grew out of all the little bits and pieces throughout the state. Every airline must have several bits and pieces, like Northern Consolidated was of four companies. To make Northern Consolidated, and they merged with Ween, and I don't know how many Ween little bits and pieces that Ween had. Even Pan American came up in the 30s and picked up some bits and pieces around Fairbanks and down in southeastern Alaska to help make Pan American out of it. So that was the way the airlines sort of got started. We this kind of grew together. Now we have some corporate giants like Wing, Alaska Airlines, and Big Bob Reeves Airlines, who has a tough road to hoe out the Aleutians to such a tough country nobody else wanted after the war. But Bob's made a pretty good thing out of it. Right now it might be a good idea to pause and salute the some of the unsung heroes of that era, were the guys that put up the dough so that we aviators could try out some of our ideas or dreams. And I like to think of them as the unsung heroes because they didn't have too much promise, and I think that very few of them ever were able to retire on the investments that they made in the early days, but I think it's appropriate that we salute them as well as some of the glory boys. And let's not forget at this time either the mechanics that kept those old airplanes going. That wasn't a very easy job. And my friend Cecil Higgins, who was in the audience here, can remember some of the problems that they had then. And about all we pilots contributed was keeping the tools warm over the fire pot. And they provided all the brains, and we just handed them the hot tools. Sometimes I'm asked the question, how tough was it? Well, it was tough. It was tough. But we didn't think it was tough because we didn't know any better. And it was tough all over the United States at that time. People were out of work. People were working for meager wages. I know in 1933, I and a lot of other out-of-work pilots were in the Boeing assembly line, getting 50 cents an hour. And I got a call from Alaska Southern Airlines to come to Alaska at $125 a month and $4 an hour. That was big money. Didn't last very long, you know, just for the summers, but while we had jobs were pretty lucky, and we didn't seem to think it was getting along without radio or some of the other niceties of life that was particularly difficult. We were getting CW radio. Bob Gleason can tell you when we started getting CW radio, but I don't remember having one in an airplane until 34, 35, along that time. But he gave me one up in Fairbanks. It was sort of like a bicycle. It was a tripod. And you could sit on this tripod and pedal like hell. And there was a key that you could send out a message while someone held the antenna off in this direction. And if you held the key down too hard, you came to a complete stop because of it. the dynamotor wouldn't carry the load. But it was a good time. I think we had a lot of fun, and I think we made good friends. We were handicapped a lot by lack of knowledge. We really didn't have many books to go by, and the only information you got over the years was what you picked up from other pilots. And as a consequence, whenever more than one pilot got together, you had a virtual convention, and you couldn't talk about anything else but airplanes and what you did and what happened and all things like that. Then that was long, probably 1938, before we began to get voice radio of any quality. In 1931, there were only three fields in the whole Costa Quim area. There was McGrath, which is a 1,200-foot field with a dogleg in it. And that was on the other side of the river from where the field is now. The Cotton had a big 600-foot field on the top of the hill. He came in through towards the hill, and when you got to the bushes, you cut the gun and you roll up over the top, and you made it every time. And the same way taking off, you just would grind up the hill, and when you started down the hill on the other side, as soon as you got through the bushes, jump it, and you had 300-400 feet. The town was way down below you. Iditarod had a think it was 800 feet with a house on the end of the field, if I remember. And that was the only thing. Anywhere else you went, you landed on a river bar. And I presume the first aviator in the spring or somebody else would kick the stumps out, maybe do a little smoothing up of the field. But river bars are a great field, and some of them quite lengthy. Then 1932, I think it was, Dean Meyring later became a PAA pilot, decided that we should know about instruments. So we taught each other how to fly by instruments. And there again, we didn't have many books to go by. We were both naval reservists. Aboard a Curtis fledgling from the Navy, they said, well, we're to have 10 hours apiece, which we got in, and we got what we thought was pretty good. And then we bought some more time in a small plane there at Boeing Field. But we never could get an instrument test from the CAA because it only had a little ball and turn in it, and the inspector wouldn't let us take a test unless we had the new big ball and turn. So we never got qualified, but Gene became quite qualified because he ended up flying jets to London for PAA, so I guess he benefited by our really self-instruction. This is something that all pilots used to have to do, and that was to buy things for people. Buy me this, buy me that, everywhere you went, because you were the shopping representative. And nowadays you want to ship a passenger to the airline, and you have to go in and go sign about six papers and triplicate or quadruplicate or maybe that thick. I haven't tried it lately. They pay anything up to $5, $7, $18 for a package. The way I used to do it, at that time I wore a regular Pearson jacket. This pocket was my money pocket. And people say, Bob, get me this in town. And of course, there were a variety of articles. I remember once I bought a white wedding dress. I suppose he had it for $10. I finally had to pay $12. But you buy these articles, and when I go into the store, I would pay for it right then and there. And I usually wheedle a little commission out of the merchant, like 10%. And so I'd write on the outside of the package, $5, if it was $5, $5. Not the $4.50 I paid in, but $5. And the minimum freight rate was 25 cents. 25 cents, 5 1/4. When I went out to the village, here's your package. Give me 5 1/4, I put it back in the pocket. This is the cash flow in here. And that was my money. I was spending money, came out of there, and once in a while I'd get so much money in there that I could take $10 out and put it on the books. Ordinarily, that was just a slow deal. There's some funny things happened in those days. It was numerous incidents. I used to fly a little Waco on floats, not very big. There was this fat lady in Craig, and you can't hardly believe how fat she was. She was so big, every time she wanted to come to town, we had to make 2 trips to get her in. The later version of the same story was after the war, we were flying both Cessnas and Drummond Goose, and that was about the fat lady who couldn't get into the Cessna, so we gave her a goose. Yeah. I'm a little over my time, but I started late, so I'm going to talk a few more minutes, if you can bear with me. Some of the stories we like to talk about are blissful stories. And this particular story is blissful. And I'm not too modest on that. Those who remember the OX-5 days, you started an airplane by twisting the prop. And by the time you got up to something as big as the Liberty, maybe it took a two or three guys to twist the prop, and later on we began getting starters. We had the old inertia starter that turned the crank. And then eventually we got the electric starters. That was pretty good. You press the button and well, during the war, some smart people decided that they'd build a shotgun starter. And that was where you had a, just like a shotgun shell, and you put it in a breech, and you press the button, and it went bang, and it really kicked that engine over several revolutions quite fast. It was a very effective kind of a starter. It said that they would clog up from time to time, and wouldn't work, and the only cure was to take it off, clean it up, and put it back on again. And I was in the Kingfisher squadron during the war, and we had a single engine 400 Pratt & Whitney R985, 450 horse. And whenever these starters would go haywire, I would show the boys how to start it. And so they thought this was pretty good. It wasn't hard to do because the engines were brand new, and all you had to do was get that past one cylinder and bang, it would go away. It was a little difficult because they were flying on floats, and you had to stand on the side of the float and hang on to the edge of the cowling and reach over here and turn the prop. Anybody could do it if you get one short of help. Anyhow, the story is that I was flying from, I was flying a plane to ABAC, and I'd left Dutch Harbor for ABAC. Nice day, big wind from Bering Sea, and the cowling started coming loose. Well, that's the deal. I go back, I have to, if I go back to Dutch, I might make it before it comes loose. I might go on the bathroom, I might make it before it comes loose. You just stand over there, and 1 minute from the Bering Sea side, and then halfway through it was a little strip of land. In a knee behind the land. A big white thing itself in the center of itself. That land behind there and passed it in the beach. And GIs came out of the bushes. They had some kind of an outpost there and they tried to bust them in. Anyhow, we fixed the cowling, secured it. And they turned me around. I said, now don't throw them in the engine stuff. And okay, well, when I put a shotgun in there and went, and they thought that was the end of that, but it wasn't, so they turned me loose. And I went drifting down the bay, shooting shotgun shells in there, and I knew they weren't going to work. And I just got, and pretty soon they got in the big swells and the white tanks. And I had a rear seat man who I picked up in the back. He may have been a human for all I know. He would have gone to the ride. I said, do you know how to start these things by hand? I said, well, you sit in my suit. And you do just what I tell you to do. I said, I was very upset because I didn't want to get myself on the airplane. And I put the box out. And I put the box to the suit line. Sit down, come up. And I just told the government $60,000 on shore. And of course, it was an uncomfortable experience for the two of us because if we had drifted to the head of the bay, we would have been in dire straits. There was no rescue. We didn't have that. The swim of shore, she was racist. So I really excuse my vanity and put it on shore. Sort of think of decorations, and there's a lot of other people that see that in the world. The decorator of the 70s and so forth. I think the decorator of the 20s were the sort of the discovery years when we began to realize that an airplane could be used for something more than doing the joy hop. The 30s would be the years when we made do is that we could get mostly second-hand airplanes. The airplanes we should have been second to the first one, but when they actually found a good deal of engineering and effort we made do for the 30s. The 30s are the classic levels.
We'll take time on two professions and then to the end of the conversation.